Hi, Sue Hall and Tristan McDonald here. Delighted to kick off our third series of podcasts. And because it's December, we're focusing on our gift of dyslexia, our ability to alter perception. Very often, we talk about the ability to see things from all angles in our imagination, but altering our perception is not confined to the visual. Often, our hearing is altered, our sense of touch and smell. So, talents can arise in the visual world of design, for example, but also music and cooking. Jamie Oliver always springs to mind for me in that world. Today we're venturing into the world of sound with a wonderful, kind-hearted musician, Ed Roman. I am very ignorant of the world of music. All I know is that he can sing, play guitar, drums, piano, and write lyrics, and he's won many awards for all of the above. Ed, it is an honor to have you with us today, so please continue with the introduction.
Great being here with you. Fill in the blanks. I'm a bass player by trade. I always gravitated to string instruments. Once again, the 3D environment, tactic response. Anything that was involved with music, even from a young mind, was just so exhilarating to me. There were so many facets to the physical aspect of it. As I became older, I realized, other than the excitement of it, there's philosophy, history, just the personal development in other ways that is almost like a philosophical lifestyle. I struggled immensely, like many dyslexic academically. But, you know, again, my household was just a vibrant grouping of people from Eastern European grandparents and a loving grandmother and grandfather, my mom and dad, who were sort of the 50s ilk, and then my brothers and sisters, who were children of the 60s and 70s. There was just a plethora of music and styles, and people's appreciation for what it was, it seemed to be so exuberant. As a young person, seeing my grandmother sing everything from a Beatles tune to something from Frank Sinatra to these Eastern European songs that I still remember, to my mom singing me things when I was a child, like John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt, but then turning me on to stuff like Buddy Rich and Cole Porter, and hearing stories about seeing her Buddy Rich in Toronto when she was a young girl, going to these dances and big band things that were really popular. Of course, my grandmother loved Glenn Miller and all these other big, huge band artists. My brothers and sisters were 10, 8, 6 years older than I, so I'm getting fed things from like Deep Purple to the Beatles to like John Denver, Bob Dylan, the
Wow.
Grateful Dead. And then as I came into like my peer group, even in grade school, it seemed like if you were attached to some sort of organized form of music, it meant something to you, other than the quintessential cover of like, I'm into this, it's rock and roll, it's da 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 da. The lyrics were something that propelled me every day because I struggled. Somehow having all of that color and texture and everything really helped me on my journey. And I've never looked back. I've used it as my tool, my weapon, my security blanket. I make my living. It's everything to me. And it can also be sometimes a crutch, just like everything in life. So I have to also remember to separate myself from it because there's so many other things in life to enjoy and appreciate, and I try to do that as much as I can.
My questions may appear very simplistic, but I'm going to go for it. So, our gift of altering our perception, we see 3D things from different angles, we hear things from different angles. Are you aware of using your gift when, for example, you write the lyrics, or do you see a scene and do you describe it?
Your question is immense because I really started to look at them earlier in a bigger way. And I started to think, it's not really only in the last couple of years of my life that I kind of realize what that is, that three-dimensional way of thinking. I used to think it's a fantasy thing. It's imagination. Your head is in the clouds. I love that one.
Yeah.
But imagination to me is the light of creation. It intermingles with so many different things. Am I aware of it? Now I am, but I don't want to think about it too much. I just want to let it happen. What's nice about it is being able to analyze it, describe it in my circumstances so other people can kind of feel it and understand it and maybe know that they're not alone or that, hey, wait a minute, this is a sort of a gift. I like this. That all of that has really only come in the last couple of years because working with you and the society and approaching it from that clinical perspective, I guess, has made me look at it and magnify it for myself so I can articulate it in some way.
Wow.
So, you see, I'm on the simple stretch here. I love it. If you think of a song, does a lyric come first? Does a chord come first? Do you have any idea how you compose?
That's a great question. And again, I try not to limit it. You know, I always remember the Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams sitting there with the book about Pritchard and ripping the page out, talking about the scale as to what makes poetry and language work. I don't think we can put it in a box or sanitize it in any kind of way. It's always happening in some way. Because I'm so tactile, and between drums, my bass, my keyboard stuff that's here, percussion things, all of my guitars, there's always some intermingling of and trying and playing with ideas in that three-dimensional way. I'm here touching it, I'm feeling it, and I'm paying attention to the emotional value of it. And that emotional value is what drives me in the thinking process to lyric, perhaps. What about it is exciting me in that way that really makes me want to go and write something about it? The opposite is always happening too, where I'm always scribbling down ideas in a stream of consciousness, almost editing myself. Sometimes it's more precise because everything is sort of aligning in this sort of fundamental idea. But other times I don't want to like restrict it to saying, well, let's just think this way about it. So everything sort of comes out. With that said, the color of what the language is starting to offer me, because I'm trying to let the experience pull me through it. What are all these different things turning on in my mind about the catalyst of the idea? And then I start going, okay, this is how, like in the three-dimensional mind, my imagination, how do I organize this? And somehow the outline of everything starts to say, no, this is where I'm sort of leading to, is that the process is leading me through it. I've learned to really relinquish my ego in the process of writing, because I used to think, well, I should write a song like this. When you're a younger writer, you're so enamored with the people that you love and stylistic things and certain ways that things are sort of pronounced or said or outlined to the listener. But, you know, finding your own voice, and I've been writing a lot of articles and for different magazines and blogs and things, is just that. It's even relinquishing all of the things that we so greatly appreciate and allowing yourself to sort of circumnavigate around that to say what you really want to say. You know, a long time ago, a good friend of mine said to me, you know, Ed, even with the sound of your voice, we even imitate certain people. I love imitating as a dyslexic. It was one of the things I did as a kid. My parents would call people, do your Alfred Hitchcock, do your so-and-so, right? That's fine. And then all of a sudden he said to me, you know, I love your natural voice. I thought, but if I say it like this, it doesn't sound like so-and-so. That's okay. And embracing yourself is the most important thing of all. It really helps me, even with my own insecurities through dyslexia, say, this is Ed, and this is what I got to say.
I just thought of a question when it comes to writing music as well as the lyrics. When you imagine writing a song, are there images that come up? Because we think in this 3D image kind of way of what a particular sound sounds like in an image-based way.
Yes, yeah. All the time. Like, just as you said that, I was doing this stuff the other day, working on this kind of like funk thing, right? And for some reason in my mind, I have, sorry to say, these legs and these Czech polyester pants doing this crazy dance, right? And that may be a flash of an image that goes through my head, but it's what the music and the feelings of everything that I'm working on conjure. And I'm laughing because it's actually one of the propellants of moving forward through the process that doesn't make it a struggle. It makes it like exciting and fun.
Yeah.
Something called synesthesia, which I'm sure you're aware of, where people cross over their senses. So you can have people who smell sights and people who see music in colors. When you see like a sheet of music, does it come up as
absolutely
a color for you?
And reading is dialogue. It's almost like trying to memorize script. If you're working in performance theater or something, movies, the relationship to that is so flat to me. That's actually why, in the weirdest of ways, I could already play music before I could start to read. When I started reading music, I almost felt infantile again, because I was going through this process of, okay, three blind mice. And that's what made me work harder in that other part of my brain that was driven in that other two-dimensional environment. But where it comes off the page is through the performer. I've seen different people that have committed 32 pages of a violin concerto to memory, and they have the music in front of them. they've worked on it. They've studied it. They may be working and phrasing and barring 16, 32 bars at a time, whatever it may be. But it's the embracement of that information that allows the artist to let it leap from there in that way. But the two-tiered part of your question, sorry, because I was getting all excited about leaping off the page.
I think I was saying that when you have senses that cross over, if you were to see a sheet of music, would it come up as a color?
And that's where I would say no. Where it comes into color is in the performance. Without having the page of music in front of you, playing certain chords, chords are such wonderful examples of that because there are all these points that meet, whether discord is purposeful, flat fives, the tritone in a chord placed correctly, it has the right kind of spice, or something just as powerful as like an E major chord on an electric guitar. It's like red, you know, it's definitely showing color. I think that's also what drives the body through the process, other than the rhythm, the cycles of things and how it's interacting to that. That to me is also a big part of my rhythmical connection to it, because it's so intermingled with my body movement and how I feel inside of performing. A lot of my mechanics when I'm performing, I'm very active. I'm active for a reason, because I cannot help but have it be symbiotic with what I'm doing. Sometimes it's complicated what I'm doing, but it's strange that some of this added movement to what I'm doing is what synchronizes everything for me. So body movement in that three-dimensional form is also designing a pattern behind what the music is making me feel and how I'm feeling inside of the music. I see that as extremely three-dimensional. That's another reason why I love dance. I've always been enamored with ballet or Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. Oh my gosh, unbelievable three-dimensional body movement.
What I'm picking up is that your process is very organic, obviously, and there's a little bit of a structure in terms of chords, maybe, but most of it is organic and the movement is organic. And this leads me to one question. When I look at books, I see authors who are technically correct. They make sentences that follow a structure and they're very technically correct. And then I see authors who just, the words come out as if they were talking to you. And I see those two differences in books. Do you see those differences in music?
Absolutely. And this is what's really interesting, that organized idea of structure, an introduction, verse, chorus, let's have a bridge, a summation, chorus out. Those are very typical structures inside of songwriting. A stanza, connections, the way that they function rhythmically, the way they rhyme, rhyming schemes. They can almost be predictable inside of commercial music. And that's another reason why perhaps maybe not as a literary mind would gravitate towards it, because it understands the comfort of the scheme. But at the same time, in the last maybe 15 years of my life or longer, Picasso once said, you know, not all art was meant to be understood immediately. It's just meant to be felt and observed. And people like Tom Waits and other people that sort of paint language in this absurd way that almost seems like they're more than just telling you a story. They're right there in front of you, pulling you through the experience. But at the same time, they're not in a literary fashion describing everything. They're allowing the listening mind to navigate in its own way through those colors and things that are like that. And I've been really enjoying that about my own personal experience of writing. Sometimes it happens in a much more fluid way that, you know, somebody would gravitate to. But other times people are like, what do you mean when you're talking about that? I'm like, I don't know. What does it mean to you? I really enjoy that part of it, but I definitely see it in the music field with certain things, even outside of language, with the tapestries that are offered from so many genres. They are far more organized in a commercial sense. In other ways, they're really wide, an incredibly huge palette that a lot of people maybe not are always going to relate to immediately, but they're being created and they're beautiful from both perspectives.
And they reach different people. The structured people reach the linear sequential thinkers, and the organic, spill it out as it comes, reach the non-verbals.
Absolute.
But one for everybody.
My brain kind of got a little off topic. I was just thinking, when it comes to music and even cooking, like when it comes to painting, I guess it's not what you see, it's how you see it and how you depict it onto the canvas. And it's almost, this might be a terrible comparison, but people who are professional cooks, when they're making a really good meal, and you can put all the right ingredients into it and it'll be correct, just like how a musician plays all the right notes and all the right chords, but if there's no expression into it, it's not going to come out specifically as your piece of art, if you know what I mean by that.
Yeah, and it's ironic that you bring up Cook and Sue earlier with Jamie, because I love cooking. It's so three-dimensional, and again, it's like, well, what do we want to eat tonight? What would you like to eat? That's there. That's the idea. Now, what's fun in the kitchen is working backwards, trying to figure out if everything is there. Okay, now there's a conundrum and there isn't any cheese. So what do we do now? That is another part of that three-dimensional way of thinking. It's, again, working backwards, or then now we can move forwards because we understand what all that back information is. So often the idea of the last thing I want to say is really what ironically hits the page first. The catalyst, which has pulled me through it, just like cooking the meal, in the end is really the final outcome. In a different way, it's doing the same thing. But again, the cooking is a wonderful metaphor because I can understand completely why people would gravitate to it in the art form.
Yeah.
I tend to work the other way around. I see what's in the fridge and what can I make out of it.
But see, that's why I'm not going to limit myself either too, because I'm like the fridge prowler at 11:30 trying to figure out, do I want to make something formidable? Do I wait till tomorrow morning? No, let's make this because we have I love going to a store because I grow food too. Choosing things or looking at it or finding out who, what, where, why, and how. People are like, it's an orange. Why do you care? I don't know. That's kind of the way my mind has always worked. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's another faction of the dyslexic mind, is the curiosity is what also drives us.
That's why I love Jamie Oliver so much, because if you see him in the kitchen, he puts two things together and he's smelling them and he just knows what it's going to taste like at the end. And then all the rest of it is him just filling in the blanks until you get what was in his mind.
In the last couple of years, I have to say, like, how often I've done interviews talking about dyslexia and what we're doing. The passion word that you just mentioned is the key. Because you know what? Even if it doesn't come in that sort of fortified public image form, the day and age that we live in promotes so much of this identity through ego. That same passion and way of thinking can exist everywhere. From whether you're a wonderful shoe salesperson, to a hairdresser, to a teacher, to whatever it is. Those points as a dyslexic and the moments that I struggled academically, because it's so two-dimensional and flat. When I was so fortunate to be punctuated with a great teacher that had that passion, it helped me through that literary process to understand the information. Consequently, as a person, I gravitated so frequently to people that were passion-driven inside of the information, and it could have come from anywhere. And you mentioned Jamie. I love Jamie. I used to watch his show all the time. You know, and he's like running around, and that's it. It's also the gravitation mechanism and the magnetic mechanism to so much of what I do, because people are like, you're so happy about what you're doing when you do it. Because yeah, I'm passionate about it. I love it.
I was just thinking about, have either of you ever watched the film Ratatouille?
Love that.
Oh yeah.
That's such a great example when it comes to food and imagery and music. I remember there's a scene where it kind of cuts out all the background and it's just the little rat, and he's adding ingredients to like a stew or a soup, and every time he tastes something, a little color shows up and like a clarinet plays, just a couple notes, a little accent, that a trombone with another ingredient. I thought that was such a cool way of mixing all these different art styles together. It's so well put together how you're going to make music represent color as well as the taste of food, and how you feel the emotion when you taste that, and what is that emotion going to sound like. And I've always thought that was fascinating.
Disney, and you mentioned Ratatouille, I'm seeing the similarities in the libretto to The Lady is a Tramp.
Yeah.
I grew up watching that too. And Warner Brothers 7 Arts, I mean, as a young person and still today, when I look at that information, I'm staggered by what's going on in the relationship between color, form, the character-driven element of it, music, it's exquisite. I see them as art pieces, although it's humor. I remember this one where it's about the squirrel that finds a bowling ball. And I think he thinks that it's a nut. And the whole little episode is about him trying to break this bowling ball. And the music, the animation, the function of the character, it's so elaborate and beautiful. It exemplifies exactly what you're saying with Ratatouille. It's just turning on all these different things in the viewer's mind that you're like, wow,
yeah,
this is beautiful. Yeah. You know, it's funny, if I may add, talking about all this, how in the weirdest of ways, dyslexia in this sort of three-dimensional process also has infiltrated a big part of my healing process physically in moments where I've been injured or have trouble sleeping or other points in the physical part of my existence where that three-dimensional cognitive environment where I'm out here because the pain is intense or whatever it might be, is that I'm using it to help me get through this. I've even been like, I remember once I dropped a barbecue grate on my foot when I'd been cleaning it. The pain was excruciating, but I remember being on the ground in this fetal position. And I know the pain was there, but this sort of musical idea started coming to me and humming it and going through this process of pain, but at the same time, using that to get me through that. And since I started to look at that, I started to look at other artists. It's also really been a part of, like, even when I've been sick or have felt ailments, I have to say it's been a healing mechanism, and I'll use it again.
And I understand this. So we have this ability to alter our perception. So are you saying that your reality is you're in pain, but if you can alter your perception to not feeling the pain, then it's a gift? Very cool.
I'm just trying to make sure I understand. So it's allowing you to take yourself out of yourself. Let's step away from this situation. I'm in pain, but we're going to have to deal with this. How can I deal with this?
Even in circumstances where I wasn't injured, but I knew that I was in trouble.
Mm.
How am I observing the situation? What's about to happen? Where can I flee to? How do I dissolve this language? That's another one of those moments where it's a fight or flight thing. And I've recognized it as that. And so yes, 100%, both of you, field goal.
There's a film called What the Bleep Do We Know? And what they describe is this point of perception. I think they call it the observer. So I think they're talking about the same thing, that we have this ability to observe ourselves, if you like, and to see the situation and how we can deal with it.
Absolutely. And that altering of perception is the vehicle to get you through it.
So if I can pull in a few threads here, we've got this wonderful creative mind, obviously, and it pulls in all sorts of talents. It pulls in musical talents and visual talents and artistic talents, and we can weave them all together and create something quite beautiful. And because we have this ability, we probably end up being those people who make films, who compose music. Would you agree?
Yes, 100%. And the list is endless too.
People with dyslexics, do you think they gravitate towards things like that in art because it's less structured? Earlier today, we were talking about how there is no box. We're just always thinking outside of the box. In order to focus on mathematics or languages, I have to force myself into a box because it's structured. Like, obviously, there's still structure behind music, but if you don't have the imagination, you're not going to create beautiful music.
Structure is integral. And yeah. I think that through that process of discovery, that it becomes self-evident. Even Sue, as an author, I know that struggling with language, she's an accomplished author. People say, how can you do that? That means that she's worked to understand how language flows, how she wants to speak. All the same things that I remember doing as a young musician through the process of people that I enjoyed.
Just leaving that creative side for a little while, do you find that there are any other areas in your world where altering perception is useful? We hear about entrepreneurs being able to see a challenge from all different angles. We hear about people being able to navigate themselves through fog. We hear about comedians who see a scenario in real life and they twist it to be humorous. And people design additions to their homes and people play sports.
I love your question. I have to say, I love it. Yes, 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 and yes. I had so many wonderful moments in my life being a clown. And maybe in some cases, through the insecurity of what I was dealing with. I understand that more now. And being a heavy child, that was a whole other frequency of insecurity, right? But the dyslexia is definitely something that made me behave in a way that I was trying to like show that I had intellect. I could paint something in a way that could create attention. So I wasn't limited to what the report card said. I remember these moments in grade school where the teacher's talking, and then they'll bring up a word. And because my mom was so like word safari and always helping me practice reading, I had a great vocabulary as a young person. So I would be this person that had their hand up in class. I remember, 20 some odd kids or 30 kids turning around and look at me like, oh, Ed knows what perplexed means. And I liked that. And I liked then using that in a character-driven way in moments where people were in a bad mood. It was a big part of why I also gravitated to theater, because those moments changed that environment. It changed that perception. I used to love artists, music people would say, okay, for the next 2 hours, this is just our little world. And in those 2 hours, you're altering the perception of the person thinking through the process of performance. Even in moments not on a stage, I relish the opportunity to be theatrical in my explanations about things. Because as I mentioned before, to your wonderful question, it's a big part of the learning mechanism. People have said, Ed, you're like a human gargoyle when you're on stage. And I'm like, yes, I like that feeling,
It's fun getting them to enjoy what you're feeling.
Oh, and right. When I can jam with somebody and they're right on it, it's wonderful.
I see that. Did you play much sport? Did you ever play hockey or soccer?
I did. As a young person, I was enamored with baseball. I love baseball. I was a great back catcher. I was a good pitcher. I even pitched for a league above me. My dad was an exceptional athlete, and so was my brother. My dad, he was drafted by the Toronto Argonauts as a young man. Oh, wow. He played for St. Mike's as a star running back. The sports ethic in me was pretty big in my house, skating all winter long. Yeah, and today, hockey. My dad was like, no, we're going to get you playing hockey, take me to power skating. I'm trying to get somebody to fence with me. I really like the idea of fencing. Like, I don't know, there's something really romantic. And I did it sometimes when I was in high school, never like competitively, but I really enjoyed, in the gym or in the hall when we weren't supposed to.
Well, going back to those sports like hockey and soccer, the reason I brought that up is because Wayne Gretzky knows that he alters his perception when he plays hockey. He knows that he sees the game from above, right? Which obviously gives him more information than a typical person. I'm sure a lot of athletes do that, but they probably do it without knowing they do it. And it translates into that little guy who knows where to be on the soccer pitch. And his coach says he's always in the right spot at the right time.
Yes. I had so much trouble skating. I was devastated because my dad was a great skater. My brother was an incredible skater. And I was like, ankles on the side and wearing ankle supports and slipping and falling. I had a dream one night. I remember it so vividly like it was yesterday. And I was skating on this big, huge frozen space in this pasture that we had. And I could see myself doing it. I was like, yes, I can skate. Literally, the next day when I put skates on, I was so much more confident, relaxed. I could start skating backwards, all the things I wanted to do because I was better at defense, because I was a bigger kid. And I remember saying to my mom, Mom, I had a dream the other night that I could skate, and today I can skate. She's like, see, I told you. She was always like confirming the magic, right?
You were invited to enter your own imagination and do what your imagination told you could do.
Exactly. And it's funny because I see that happening today with certain things, even like on a journey, if I'm going to go somewhere, predicating my trip ahead of time. Young drivers, they call it planning your route. And I think they do that so that you're dimensionally aware of your process. I think it's really healthy.
Some of my kids are pretty good skiers. When they're racing, they're taken to the top of the run and the coach sort of visualizes them going down the hill. And so they have it in their head and they know where they're going before they're just following their image.
Absolutely. And it's funny, all the things I've been thinking about before our podcast today and all the different positive aspects of the way we think and behave and interact. But it has struck me that the delinquent mind is also, I think, another part of this portion of people that are leaving academia that end up in this existence is a big part of that three-dimensional thinking. I've seen some things, although they'd be criminal, in a form of brilliance that almost exemplify an artistic act. There was a bank robbery that happened a number of years ago in France. And the thieves themselves, I'm sure dyslexic-minded, developed and devised this elaborate plan in order to break into the most well-protected safe in Paris. And through the process of weeks of digging under buildings and under a pool and all this stuff, they break into the safe. They loot the safe, all the safety deposit boxes. But in there, what they bring with them are like fresh baguettes and pâté and champagne and burgundy wine. And they sit and they have this immensely beautiful meal to celebrate their victory, right? And just the mindset of being able to even do anything like this. And on the walls, they write, without violence, without crime, with only passion. They didn't see what they did as a crime. They saw it as an act of passion. Somehow that delinquent aspect I can relate to. I participated in everything from making moonshine, doing silly things as a youngster that's like most of us. I'm sure part of my dyslexic mind is more driven by what the outcome can be than the process of saying, well, I'm just going to engage in it because it's hilly-nilly. The byproduct of knowing I can is a big part of what drives that aspect in the delinquent mind. So on the other side of the coin, it's there too in another way.
And I'm going to bring that back to cooking because Jamie Oliver, he has this wonderful cookery book that's called Five Ingredients. And he has photographs of those five ingredients that he needs down the side and the end result. To me, that's the perfect cookery book because I can see what it's going to finish up with. I can see what I need, and he's just going to give me the instructions. If I were given a cookery book that had no images, it would be on the regifting list. I need to see what the outcome is. I need to see the end result. And is it worth spending all that time in the kitchen?
You know what? 100%. More recently, I've been handed contractual agreements for publishing and licensing agreements for certain things for the music. Jargon and so forth, therefore, inside of the concession. I hired a lawyer, entertainment people, to help me understand they can do just that. Here's the picture, Ed. Yes, no, go. Yes, no, no. I need it simplified for me because I'm not that way.
Not at all. I agree with you. Yeah. And going back to the clown part, so many comedians, their way of getting through school was to be the class clown because they had to have some sort of street cred. They have to have some sort of power. And you've got Robin Williams and you've got Jay Leno and you've got people who started off just as the class clown and ended up making their living.
I know, it's amazing. And again, I find the art form almost akin to music because it has so many of the same values inside of it. It's improvisational. There's sometimes, you know, you would listen to people like Johnny Carson talk about scripts or sketches and stuff. But when you're jamming like Robin would do, that's like Coltrane. That's like Charlie Parker. That's like Mingus. It's so full of just expression and flow and stature and history. I mean, that mind is absorbing information at such an alarming rate, can organize it in such a way in its fluid fashion that you just go.
You also have a farm. You said you grow food, don't you? Do you plan out the farm in your mind? Do you have pictures that you work towards?
Yeah, farming is, again, like writing. It asks of me. Sometimes there's a timing factor. I'm rotating things in order for sustenance for the earth so that it's not depleted minerally. But I want to know the relationship to them and how they function together in a community. That's very important to me. The rest of it is, even though organized, there's all my rows of potatoes, there's all my peppers, there's all my tomatoes. And I try to let it be chaotic in its zones. And again, follow what it asks of me. Hey, the tomatoes need pinching. I have potato bugs to pick. I need to weed the corn. Those are all the physical aspects that, and to me, the weirdest of ways is the drudgery of reading. whereas then using all that stuff from the garden to create a meal for people and myself, family, whoever it may be, is the palate. That's why I get so excited about it because it's right in my backyard.
I think we've covered so much, Ed, don't you?
I do.
So many different aspects of where this altering perception is so beautifully creative and exciting and passionate.
And even on that note, like with Red Omen and what we've done for raising awareness and all the stuff that's happened, it's been such an exhilarating trip for me because so many people I've met where it's played. It played on a huge screen in front of the Eiffel Tower for 3 nights. Moscow, Milan, Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, Mexico, Sweden, Germany, all these places around the world that have seen this video and have been a part of this event, this journey. But altering perception through the digital ether, it has been a big part of the struggle of dealing with it sometimes. It hasn't always been fecundity through the process. And letting people know that even if it's not something huge that's happening, it is formidable in a positive way. People may see it and go, oh, I had no idea. And to me, and whatever is going on behind the scenes, well, it's like, it is a small victory, but it's not like, you know, I want to write a check for $100,000 for the organization and the things that I'm working on that people know nothing about. I'm always keeping that perception in a way through that positivity, through that passion. It's really helped me and that mission through its entire process. It's lonely getting on a train with nobody to talk about everything that's going on, but it's exciting when I present it in that way. And I'm always trying to remind myself, be positive, because it's really great.
Red Omen is so unbelievably successful. You've won so many awards with it. And just to explain to people who are listening, your name is Ed Roman. So Red Omen is a play on your name, and it's your musical and video tribute to how you grew up as a child with dyslexia. Am I right?
That's absolutely. And it's filled with allegory and sort of all ideas and colors. And people might say, well, how are you literally talking about dyslexia in this video? And I've sort of answered, I am a dyslexic. I wrote it about my life and my experiences. There are little stories about Jimi Hendrix and UFOs, and they're all part of family allegory and things that have happened in my life. But the summation of it exists in the last verse, where I say, I didn't believe in myself if no one else, because dyslexia can remove that. It can kill it in a person. And that's probably why so many people struggle and quit. But it's a beautiful thing. We all have that ability inside of us. So I'm so happy that it's become what it is. It's a good podcast. Yeah. We laugh.
Recognize for what it is. Yeah. For too long, too many people have been putting negative spin on it. And it's not a negative thing to have.
No, it's not. And Sue, when I first started speaking with her and started reading her book and listening to other people like Brody, a good friend of ours, it's a script writer, or public figures like Henry Winkler. It's a gift. Putting that label on anything from autism. I've worked with autistic children before as a music teacher, and they're some of the most intellectual people I've ever worked with. Labels, unless you're trying to figure out what size jeans to buy, can literally destroy somebody. And I'm lucky that I had good parents and a good family, and I forged ahead with friends that said, you can do this, and didn't listen to teachers that told me I wasn't going to amount to anything. And I went, no, it was a struggle, though, you know, and that label made that struggle even harder.
Well, if you could choose, would you choose to be dyslexic if you were born again?
Absolutely. I really mean that. I now see this more as something that is a learning mechanism for everybody. It's funny, talking to people outside of the dyslexic community about all of this, even about how perhaps some days things like this could enter into educational processes. It's such a big part of the learning experience. Tesla is one of my heroes. Now, whether or not it's documented as him being a dyslexic or not, point being is that it works in the same facet. There's so many things that are always going on in your mind. And when you can organize them and play with them, they may not even be complete, is happening everywhere. And aligning everything so perfectly inside of the mechanism of structure of academia can be really unhealthy. I think children, especially young children, need to be connected to their environment. Farm and agriculture is not a bad thing at all, because it really gets them involved in that thinking environment outside of just, I'm planting a seed. So I would like to say, embrace it. It's a gift. I feel lucky in my position now, as opposed to feeling like I got a problem.
We're all lucky. We're lucky to have you. I can't tell you how grateful I am for you being part of this podcast series.
Sue, thank you so much. And I'm honored to be a part of the event for the seasonal podcast. And Tristan, it's nice meeting you.
Thank you so very much.
My pleasure, Sue. Anytime. Yeah. Pleasure.
Well, the fun part about talking to Ed Roman is that you have no idea where he's going to take you, but it is a guarantee that it will be fun. What a colourful, honest, vulnerable, passionate man. And we're so grateful for his contribution. Our website is www.thewds.org. And if you go to the Take Action page and the Donate page, you can see a trailer of Red Omen, which is on our Vimeo link. If you'd like to get hold of us, you can always email info@thewds.org, and we can always pass on a message to Ed Roman. So I hope that your December is going very well, and we look forward to you joining us on our next podcast, which will be with Alison Edgar, who is known as the godmother of entrepreneurs. She joins us from the UK, and we'll see you there. Take care.